Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Bob Weeks, a member of the Commonwealth Club Program Committee, also a member of the House of Delegates of the American Bar Association, and your chair for this program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. It's now my privilege to introduce today's distinguished guest, Laurel Bellows, President of the American Bar Association. With nearly 400,000 members, the ABA is the largest voluntary professional membership organization in the world. Ms. Bellows' topic is the fight for liberty, equality, and justice, and she will address some current battles in that eternal fight, including inadequate funding for the courts, human trafficking, and gender inequity in pay. A lawyer for over 30 years, Ms. Bellows is in practice with her husband, Joel Bellows, in the historic Rookery Building in downtown Chicago, where she represents business executives in the United States and overseas, negotiating employment and separation agreements. She's admitted to practice before the United States Supreme Court in Illinois, in Florida, and right here in California. She's been admitted since 1981. Laurel and Joel have four children and four grandchildren. Now, Ms. Bellows' resume glows with honors like most influential, power player, and power lawyer. She was the second woman president of the Chicago Bar Association, where she founded the Women's Alliance, president of the National Conference of Bar Presidents, chair of the ABA Commission on Women in the Profession, chair of the Chicago Network, a diverse group of professional women. Ms. Bellows is the fifth woman to lead the ABA, and is a powerful and persuasive and passionate advocate for the cause of equal justice under law. Now, from the city of broad shoulders, the lawyer who can handle big tasks and important issues, the lawyer with broad shoulders, please welcome my friend and our speaker today, Laurel Bellows, President of the American Bar Association.
Well, thank you, Bob. So those of you who can't see me know that I've just went from 4'11 to 5'6", and it's a wonderful new perspective, all right? And I not only can see over the podium, but I feel more in touch with you, and that's why we do that. Bob, that was a fabulous introduction. My mother would not have done as well, right? And I want to thank you for all your hard work in putting this together, and George Dobbins for welcoming me so generously to this remarkable, remarkable place where conversation is so extraordinary to the point and open, the open sharing. And I'd also like to thank my friends Drew Ramey and Mark Schickman and John McDonald for making this happen, because this is truly an honor to be with you today. And a particular thanks also, I'm going to thank him now because I'm not sure how I'm going to feel about him after the moderation takes place, because he gets to actually choose the questions that I have to answer. So I want to be your very best friend at the moment, Jeffrey Brandt, Dean of the University of San Francisco Law School, for graciously agreeing to moderate today's program. I am very, very honored to be here. I believe in the power of community, and that is why this is such a special opportunity for me. I believe in the power of individuals to affect change, but I believe in the extraordinary power of a community to come together and change our world or preserve it. And so that's a little bit about what we're going to be talking about today. As president of the American Bar Association, I've been traveling the country and the world on behalf of an association that has tremendous roots both in our country and all over the world, as we strive to preserve the rule of law here and abroad in many different areas. I want to touch with you on several issues today. First, I want to remind you that we have just celebrated Law Day, which is May 1st, which was started by the American Bar Association and then brought to every corner of our country to discuss one issue a year, public education. And this issue this year was realizing the dream, because we were celebrating the 150th anniversary of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. We were celebrating the Equal Pay Act coming together 50 years. We'll talk about that in a second, 50 years on June 10th. We were celebrating the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. We were talking about, but perhaps not celebrating, the fact that we are coming up on 50 years of the Civil Rights Act and Title VII, and discussing today a little bit of how effective or ineffective that law is. But we were talking about the power of a community in the United States of America that does, though some for some much more slowly than it should, but does come around to recognize that we all are equal under the law and continues to strive, no matter how difficult that goal is, that aspiration continues to strive for access to justice for all, and beginning to admit that that's not an easy path. But if we forget that that's what we're about, all right, we forget how important it is to be American here in the United States. When every single time I come back into the United States of America with my passport, maybe I'm a little too emotional, but when I hear that welcome back from the customs official, and my daughter, Lindsay, who's here today, knows it, I cry. There's always a tear in my eye to know that as many important issues and crises that face us in this country, we are the lucky ones who were born in the United States of America. We are the lucky ones who have the power to welcome immigrants into the United States of America. Though we will not be talking about it today, we are the ones with the power to make immigration an important and wonderful experience, as opposed to the negative experiences so many of the people who want to be a part of this country and work with us for justice are experiencing. So with all the problems that I'm about to detail to you, and today I'm afraid it's going to be a little douse in depression as opposed to a douse in glass half full, but I'll try and remember every once in a while to bring you glass half full. With all of that, what I want to emphasize today is the passion that I have for practicing law and for being a lawyer, the incredible gift that I have to stand here as president of the American Bar Association, because it truly is an organization that is defending liberty, pursuing justice, and because of the ability of each one of us to change our world and the responsibility to do that. So let me start with something that I know that peripherally you're aware of here in California, because you have one of the finest laws in this country, and you have been recognizing the existence of human trafficking here in this country. I'm not going to speak about human trafficking going forward right now. I'm going to speak about what it is. It is modern-day slavery. We have 100,000 or more U.S. citizens in slavery in our country today. Now, I know all of you have been watching the horror of the three children who were found in Cleveland. And I want you to question why, not why it took us so long to find these three little girls, but to question why it has taken us so long as a country to understand that this horror is embedded in our country. Unfree, in the land of the free, more than, I'm giving you a minimum estimation because this is a hidden horror, more than 100,000 U.S. citizens, and then add to that the tens of thousands of men, women, and children who are brought across our borders and into our country to serve as slaves. Labor and sex, prostitution, fruit picking, short order cooks, cleaners, nannies who come over and are locked inside houses, people who are coming through agents to clean your houses who don't speak English and come from the Ukraine or Russia and other places. Atlanta, who didn't even know until this year that they were the hub of human trafficking in the United States. Seattle, that didn't even recognize until a year and a half ago that they were the hub of transmission of human beings from Asia into our country. Illinois, Chicago, where I live, 16,000 underage girls vulnerable to slavery for prostitution every year. And now what do we learn from the Cleveland experience, setting aside the hell, and I use that literally, that these children went through, and praying for their recovery and delighting with the families to be able to put their arms around their children again. What did we learn from that? It is next door to you. It's next door to you. In California, in every city of California, in every state of our country, in every corner. And what can we do about it? Not just as lawyers. One, we are, at the American Bar Association, about to pass and advocate for a uniform state law. Congratulate yourselves, Californians, because as a result of your public servants here, you have one of the best state laws in the country governing anti-slavery initiatives. But that law has to be enforced by law enforcement and prosecutors and public defenders who we refer to as first responders, the people who would first see as a defendant the person who should be treated as a victim. And the advocacy around the country now for the recognition that it is not just a working girl prostitute's crime. If it's a crime, it's a John's crime as well, and beginning to advocate for John's courts so that, though we will never end demand, we will recognize that there are two people responsible, even when we're talking about the crime of prostitution. And then we have to get into the fact that when we're talking about slavery, we're not talking about a crime of prostitution. We're talking about a child who was coerced into prostitution, either by literally kidnapping, coerced by manacles, coerced by forced addiction, coerced by fraud or threat and bodily harm to herself or to her family or to her friends. And driving this home, what I'm saying to you is these little girls on the street, they didn't choose to be prostitutes. The working girls, all right, who might choose a life of prostitution to earn money, that's one thing. The children who were brought into prostitution because they were threatened, they left an abused household only to find their savior being somebody who locks them up in chains or lets them out on the street and says, I know where you live, and you have an 8-year-old sister at home. If you want her to live, you're going to do this for me. And then there's the young girl who goes to school in high school from a family that is what you might say is a normal family. And she is a well-adjusted young woman, but she doesn't have a lot of money. And one of her, quote, friends who might be earning commission, but she doesn't know this, says to her, so you want to buy a new outfit? Why don't you just have sex with this guy and he'll pay you $100 and you can buy a new house outfit? What's the difference to you? And she says, huh, not a bad idea. So the first time she earns her $100, this little 16 or 15-year-old girl in high school, she earns her $100. The next time she earns another $100 or more or less. And then the third time she says, no, thank you. I'm not comfortable with this. I don't want to do this. It wasn't the right thing to do. And then that friend introduces her to the person, man and woman, man or woman, don't think for a second that women are not involved as captors in these crimes, reminds her that she too lives in a house and they know where she comes from. And from that moment on, she's living the horror of a double life. She goes to high school trying to keep up appearances. And when her grades fall, and when she can't survive this double life, Nobody identifies what is happening to her because she will never tell you that she's a victim of slavery, that she has a captor, because she has been threatened. Maybe they brought her in when they found her running away from an abused household and at a truck stop and offered her solace and shelter. Maybe they brought her in, taught her sex in the guise of a boyfriend, and then threw her into a room with 10 guys to be gang raped all night long with whatever implement they chose to break her like a green horse. And then she will never, when questioned by a judge or a prosecutor or even defense counsel, admit that she's a victim of slavery because she's got to protect herself or her family from this hell. So, the American Bar Association, uniform state law all over the country to begin to ramp up punishment so that this is not a simple pimp crime with a couple of years in jail, that this recognizes the kidnapping of a human being. Then, the expungement of the records of the young girls, or even not so young girls, because we're not just talking about underage human beings who are in slavery. So expungement of the records so that she can go live a life and get a job, so that she can keep custody of a child who she might have been forced to have, so that her captor could keep that child hostage and keep her in line. American Bar Association, labor, business conduct standards. Every corporation in America, but starting with the Fortune 500s and the Fortune 1000s, business conduct standards to take the profit out of slavery, to eliminate slavery from the supply chain of corporations. In California, your law, the California Transparency and Disclosure Act, a very, very strong model law that says you don't have to do anything to adjust your supply chain, but we just want you to disclose to the public what, if anything, you're doing. How fabulous, because this is not name and blame. This is name and acclaim. This is saying if you're doing something, we want to celebrate it and help you do it. At the American Bar Association, we're going to be keeping records and publishing a report of all the good things people are doing and that corporations are doing, corporate responsibility as it relates to human slavery. Employment, one of the most extraordinary things that every individual can do. All of you are working in somewhere. All of you know somebody who's an employer. If every employer in the United States of America, large and small, put a little notice in their employment manual, or if a big corporation did training as we do, the online training that every employee has to go through if they're a new employee, or annual training that says something very simple, first page, slavery. This is what it looks like, and it exists in America. It exists in your hometown. It exists a couple of blocks away from you. Two, these are the 20 ways in which you could begin to identify victims or a strange situation. Did you see a nanny who was caring for a child come in, begin to work with the child, have some freedom, and then never see her again except in the backyard? Do you see a nail salon where you're getting your nails, where the woman who when you give her a tip, somebody comes from behind her and takes that money so she doesn't have control of her own money? Ways to identify victims. And then what? Third page, very simple. Here's the international hotline to call. Make a mistake. Don't worry about being right. Call this hotline number. It is Polaris's 1-888-3737-888. Call it. They know what to do. They get in touch with law enforcement everywhere, and they know the questions to ask you. Just imagine that if 1 out of 10 calls you make, you save a human being. And more than that, you identify a captor who's doing these horrible things to more than one human being. So employment, manuals, something simple, national awareness. We could have 25 million employees on the streets of the United States trained to begin looking for the signs of victimization, because that victim doesn't come forward. That's the hardest thing here. National awareness, what the American Bar Association is about. Next, we will train all the first responders. And if you are a lawyer or in the legal profession or a paralegal, there's lots that you can do. But if you aren't a lawyer, there are other kinds of first responders. Healthcare. We want to be able to talk to the first responders in emergency rooms, just like they're trained to identify child abuse or domestic violence. They will have only 4 minutes on average to identify the victim of slavery because the captor will be rushing in to make certain that she doesn't report. So that's the kind of work that we're going to be doing as in the United States of America that the American Bar Association is proud to be leading. So let me go to the next good news. Cyber war, cyber attacks. Today, reported $45 million theft, all right, in Germany. Every day, 10,000 serious attacks on our systems that are being pushed back, but one is going to get through. We have hackers who do this for fun. We have people who want a theft identity. We have nation states trying to steal the intellectual property of this country and trying to destroy our country, trying to get control of our electric grid, push down O'Hare Airport so that there's no hope of anybody getting anywhere. All right. I was on a plane about 2 weeks ago and United Airlines was suffering a computer glitch. They didn't say to me that it was cyber, and I probably wasn't, but I have to say, all right, that that's the kind of thing we're going to be experiencing. The terror that's been identified for the future of this country is not the terror that we were thinking about. It's not the bombs. It is some entity or nation state that wants to destroy us by use of cyber. And here's the frightening part. Our own government says we are not prepared and that currently they have no way of preparing us. And to the Commonwealth Club, I want to identify some of the issues that are involved. You have information sharing questions. If there is an attack on one of our largest banks, shouldn't they be able to share that information with another of the largest banks so that they could watch out for it? And yet our regulations might be precluding that information sharing. The Securities and Exchange Commission says if a large corporation suffers some form of cyber intrusion, they must as quickly as possible, and this is correct, identify what they can about what information has been taken, if information has been taken at all, and then disclose to their shareholders in short order if there's any harm and what information has been stolen. Our government, on the other hand, says to that corporation, we don't really think we want you to shut down that intrusion. We want you to keep it open so that we can trace back maybe who it is and what they want and why they're there. And by the way, that's the easy one. Because these days, it's not only looking to steal information, it's looking to leave a little present behind, to totally destroy the system or watch what's happening. It's looking to invade our pharmaceutical companies to get information on our very best drugs and the research we're doing. So we have large corporations that are very good at protecting their security. And that would be Northrop Grumman from the defense or Microsoft or Apple or Google, the tech industries, and here in Silicon Valley, we have an understanding, but the fact is that anybody who wants to get into our systems can do so with enough money and enough time. For lawyers, we need to be talking about that attorney-client privilege and the information that we have access to in our own files and how to protect our client information from intrusions into our systems and the use of our systems as a path into our client systems. These are quite serious issues. These are issues of national security, individual liberty versus privacy, the information sharing protocols that we discuss, and who should have access to that information, and what kind of disclosures should, in fact, we should be making, and to whom, and how, and where, and guess what? You want to be frightened? Now think about your Congress. Who doesn't talk to each other? And that Congress, charged with the responsibility of coming forward with the legislation that governs these very complex issues I've just laid out. So do we have something to worry about? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we do. We have gotten a recent executive order on cybersecurity. American Bar Association is not only looking at that order, but trying to draft resolutions to figure out where we should be on behalf of lawyers and behalf of the people of this country. But it's tough. And we're nowhere near solutions. So, do I tell you go under your bed and don't come out? The answer is probably yes. all right? Because we don't have solutions. We have an internet that we can't control. And we have a wonderful country where we say freedom of speech is everything, and it is. So what degree of security are you going to give up? What degree of personal freedom are you going to give up? And then there is, interestingly enough, the younger generation who talks about everything everywhere online. All right? Everything's open. So maybe they don't seriously care about privacy in the same way that I've grown up to care about privacy. And so we have those issues. Is it an older generation that wants to teach a younger generation about the importance of privacy? Or is it an older generation that wants to learn from a younger generation about actually what is important and what are the nuggets of our freedom that we need to protect? What do we have to fight for and what don't we have to fight for? Very, very difficult issues. And I leave you with this thought on cybersecurity. Think of Hurricane Sandy. East Coast, only a small portion of New York City, shutting down the New York Stock Exchange, all communication, people having to walk down floors because there were no elevators, our elder citizens, actually prisoner in a sense, all right, unable to leave their apartments because there was no place to go, couldn't wash your hair, couldn't go to the washroom, couldn't eat because your ATM card didn't work, no cash, couldn't charge your cell phone, no electricity. If you got down the elevator, had cash in your pocket, could charge your cell phone to meet somebody for dinner. No restaurants open. No grocery store, no food, because there was no delivery to the restaurant. No delivery. All right. And that was just a 20-block or 30-block area of New York City. Imagine for a moment a cyber attack that got through and shut down all of New York, or how about all of the East Coast? What in the world would that be doing to our country? And that's a little bit of what we're facing right now when we talk about cyber attack, cyber terror, cyber theft. Those are the issues we're facing. Before I leave you, I want to talk about something that makes me very angry. So when I deal with trafficking, you know, I deal with it from the heart. Anti-slavery. This is saving human beings one by one. And when I speak about cyber, I talk to you about it from fear, straight out, abject fear. When I talk to you about gender equity, gender inequality of pay, I come from a place of anger and discouragement and questioning, what are our laws for? And here's why I want to speak to you about it. I said at the beginning of this conversation that we were going to be not celebrating, but recognizing the 20th anniversary of the Equal Pay Act. 20 years and women are making 77 cents on the dollar. White women. 60 cents on the dollar if you're an African American woman. 55 cents on the dollar if you're a Latina. Equal Pay Day, which happened to be on my birthday this year, April 9th. Equal Pay Day, the day up to which a woman needs to work in 2013 to earn the same as a guy earned in 2012. And that's the white woman, because a Latina would have to work through June. And I want to dispel a couple of myths right now. Every time I talk about equal pay, somebody says, equal pay for equal work, what does that mean? You know, are you talking about the woman's basketball team versus the men's basketball team? A woman can't really do the work a man does. No, I'm talking about comparable pay for comparable work. Same job, same responsibilities, unequal pay. Those are what the statistics are. Make no mistake, and when it's dinner or breakfast table conversation with you and your friends, and they say, Laurel, all right, pay is unequal because women choose a different path. They choose a different kind of job. They are maybe not all that uncommitted to their job, but they have other responsibilities that are more important to them. I'm saying not true. That's a myth. I'm talking about a statistic that's equal pay, comparable work, comparable hours, comparable career path choice. Yes, women and men might choose something different. Yes, 6 foot tall and muscular, I'm never going to be on a football team. But if I were, and I were good, I should get paid the same. That's what we're talking about. Sounds like it would be fun, doesn't it? You know, I would like to be the quarterback, right, and have them see if they can push me down. All right. So there are some opportunities that we haven't had because you might have tested me. And with the Kentucky Derby, all right, I would want to know that if I were riding that house, could I be a fabulous jockey? If I were riding that horse, I'd want to know that I was getting paid equally. That's what we're talking about. So the myth that women are made differently, that we have some kind of a brain that goes in different directions, that used to be the myth we were dealing with, I'm telling you, you're still hearing it. You're still hearing it. And in the law profession, lawyers are not immune for unequal pay. Lawyers are not immune. The statistics are now showing, National Association of Women Lawyers just came out, women equity partners in the top 200 largest firms in our country are making 89 cents on the dollar for the same production of revenue, same level of client. Again, the myth. This isn't about a man who's making, got a book of business that's $10 million and we're saying that the woman who's bringing in $3 million should be paid the same. No, I'm talking about revenue, income, bringing into the law firm the same, 89 cents on the dollar. Now you know why I'm angry. It's totally outrageous because we have the laws in place. We have the laws in place. And equal pay is good for business. It's not just a word. If you treat somebody unfairly, if you treat a woman unfairly, she's walking. And that's what's happening in our law firms today, and that's what's going to happen in our corporations. You pay a woman incomparably. You pay her unfairly, you lose talent, you lose perspective, and you end up with that bland, all-white guy community, which actually we've all recognized is not where we want to be. Finally, in this country, we have come to the conclusion that different perspectives and diversity are really, really important and wonderful. And yet, unless we start to recognize that equal pay is good for business, that equal pay actually pays, we are never going to be a country that can be proud to hold our head in the international community. And so I'd like to end with this, being president of the American Bar Association. Lawyers really do matter. These are the issues that we take on every single day, and that's why I'm so passionate about being a lawyer. But you don't have to be a lawyer to take on these issues. These are people issues. These are the kinds of issues that people should be rising up and talking about. And so I said to the American Bar Association, I want for equal pay a 5 million person march on Washington, D.C. And they said, oh, my God, can we impeach her? No, they did not say that. They did not say that. What they said is, Laurel, we're going to give you a virtual march. Man, woman, child, here, anybody who's listening to me, AmericanBar.org/gender equity. Look for the red heels and click. Every child and guy, your email list, go viral, please. Click for equality, AmericanBar.org/equality. March with me with these stunning red heels, all right? And show the world that America does care about equality in this country. I thank you for having me today, and I look forward to your questions.
You can stay there.
I'll be in the hot stand.
Well, first of all, I want to say our thanks to Laurel Bellows, president of the American Bar Association, and I am Jeff Brand, dean of the University of San Francisco School of Law and moderator for today's audience question period. And we do have a lot of questions, and they're incredibly articulate and break down into many categories, Laurel, and I fear we won't have time to get through them all.
Then you'll give me the easy ones.
I'm going to give you the easy ones, and they're all ones that I know you've addressed before. But I would just make a quick comment at the top, which is, you know, you talked about douses of depression and maybe the glass isn't half full. Well, I come away inspired listening to you because you're filling the cup with passion and action. And I think everybody in this room and everybody listening comes away with that.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
With that view.
Thank you very much.
So let's move right to, let's start where you started. And I think it's an interesting set of questions that have come up, and this is on the trafficking issue. By the way, when you go to the website, you'll see that the issues that Ms. Bellows has identified for her year as president of the ABA track, of course, what she has talked about today. On the trafficking issue, there's a specific question that I think represents a bigger concern. Would the ABA support no statute of limitations for civil cases against criminals and organizations that support them for sex abuse cases, particularly against children? And that individual question is of interest, but a broader question that's come up in several of these questions is, what is the relationship of due process to society's desire to obviously stem the trafficking that we all abhor?
Well, I'm going to move past, thank you, Jeffrey, the statute of limitations question, because I can't speak about what the ABA would or would not support, because that's done by a 560-person House of Delegates, representatives from all over the country, to take on an issue like that. But the issue is, our country believes that all people are innocent until proven guilty. We hear those words time and time again, but we don't understand how important those words are. That means that we have a country that puts the individual and that individual's liberty above the majority, the power of the minority in this country, given to us by the Constitution of the United States, is something that we can never underestimate and never forget. So even though we find human beings who we might not even consider to be human, we give them the right to be represented by the very best of counsel. And that's because it could happen to us. We want to protect every individual. And that is something that, from the core of my being, I believe in, not just simply as president of the American Bar Association. But then we have to have confidence in our process of justice. And as I say, it's taken us a little time to recognize that this slavery has drilled down so far into our society that we have not seen it. But now we're beginning to see. So in answer to your question, we are training law enforcement. We are training law enforcement to represent, you know, to bring in our working women, and if they are victims, to treat them accordingly and go after, in a very serious way, all right, the captors. But the right to trial by jury, the right to an attorney, it doesn't disappear just because you are the world's worst human being. I mean, what can I say to you? This is the tough stuff. This is the tough stuff that makes our country great. This is the stuff that separates us. The jury trial, we have a criminal jury trial. Our civil jury trial is the only civil jury trial in the world. You live in the country that has the only civil jury on our planet. What an amazing place this is. And yes, we pay a penalty for it, because we see people who are apparently despicable to us go on trial so that we can actually, through our law process, determine whether they are, in fact, despicable or innocent, and give them a trial before their peers, us, and give them fairness. Justice and fairness. That's our country, and it's a beautiful country.
So I appreciate that answer, and maybe this answers this question, which was asked in much more graphic terms. Is the answer, quote, more police state laws to prevent the Boston bombing by knowing more and overseeing all of our citizens and public in general in the name of Homeland Security?
It's the best question and the most difficult. It is security versus privacy. When I saw immediately on television the video of these two boys with their baseball caps being followed down the street, the first thing that came to my mind, I must admit to you, was not, ooh, they got them, but how did they get them? How did they find them so quickly? And we know how. There were security cameras on every corner in Boston. And in Chicago, we've got security cameras that my husband pays dearly for because he runs through the stoplight, but they are but they are security cameras. And when I walk in difficult areas of Chicago, part of me is grateful to see that little blue light flashing, and part of me is very frightened that I live in a country that is unceasingly moving toward government intervention with my life. How else did they find the information they had? Well, I think so. I've seen, and this is not in any way a supportable statistic, but I've seen mentioned that we've got 2 million people employed by our government. I have no idea if that's true. You know, listening into our emails, this could be an extremist use, or it could be accurate. Listening in and reading our emails, able to go into our telephone calls, you know, eavesdropping, all right? But the fact is we have the ability to do that and to be protected from this terrorism and this threat that is real and our cyber terror that is real. How much of our security are we willing to give up? And how much of our privacy are we willing to give up? And we, the American people, are going to have to make up that decision. And frankly, I have to say I'm a little disappointed in where we head, because whenever we get scared, we give up our privacy. Whenever we get scared, we give up our individual liberty. And let me tell you something else that's much more frightening to me, because it's personal and because my daughter is sitting right here in this audience. If she were threatened, if my family were threatened, I know I would give up privacy for security. I know I would. And it makes me angry that I would do that. To protect my family, I would give up perhaps some of the most important future power and freedom of the United States of America. But I think it's something that every day we need to be thinking about, because it's happening without our approval. And at least we need the choice. We need to be informed enough as a community to make a real choice as to what we're willing to give up as Americans.
Let me just wrap up the trafficking piece of this, not that we could ever wrap up the conversation, but a couple of questions came up. One was, do we really understand at this point the systemic nature of what's going on? When we have 24/7 coverage of incidents like in Cleveland, but it's more sensational than it is systemic. And then related to that, how do you address the issue of the victims not pressing charges against their captors? And I guess then that spills over into the latest Air Force report as well.
All right, so first of all, let me handle a great subject, victims and captors. What we are doing at the American Bar Association and also as lawyers, is we are turning the recovery from captors on its end. So what are the ways of eradicating slavery in this country? What are the reasons why people are doing this? Some of them are deranged. Some of the people are simply deranged, and there's nothing we can do about that. Or there are, all right, but it's not the kind of mass. But if you remove profit from this vehicle, you eliminate a good portion of this trafficking. And through what we call RICO, the Racketeering Influence Corruption Act, right? Through RICO and other vehicles, we are teaching lawyers how to sue the perpetrators after having been convicted criminally, going after their money. And that is a great question, because it's one way of handling it. Sensational coverage versus real awareness. We're getting there. At least we're talking about it in this country. A year and a half ago, before Nick Kristof came out with the back page article and said, and had that survivor, that little girl, actually he quoted her, and I don't know how many of you remember that. She said, you could call an email backpage.com's advertisements and order me and have me delivered faster than a pizza. When we started to hear that, when I say to you that the reason slavery is so profitable, that it is the fastest growing organized crime, faster than guns, other than drugs, And I tell you that the reason it's the fastest growing is because I can sell a gun only once, that gun, and I can sell a hit on drugs only once, and that hit is gone. But I can capture this little human being, and I can have her raped for my profit 20 and 30 times a day until she dies. That's profit, and that's what we have to remove. So I love the question about removing the profit from the trade. And then the national awareness. Sensationalism, no, I don't like it. But what was great or horrible or great or horrible, perverse, about the kind of coverage we're seeing is this drove home the girls next door to your house. This drove home that your neighbor, and it's going to be shown as to whether his brothers even knew what was going on, but your neighbor could be the person keeping slaves in his house or a raft of slaves someplace else, all right, because he's making a lot of money and his children are going to a private school and you don't know him as anything else other than a successful businessman.
Great. Let's we could stay with trafficking for the entire session, but let's move on to gender equity. And there are a series of questions that, of course, came in even before you had gotten to the topic. One member of our audience writes, on the issue of gender pay equity in law firm partnership ranks and general counsel positions, how can we work to require transparency in income reporting?
Oh, who fed me that one? That is a beautiful one. The American Bar Association's Commission on Women in the Profession? Yes. All right. Has a pay gap toolkit that we have just published. So one, every state and local bar association has received this toolkit so that they, and by the way, wouldn't it be wonderful if, right, this wonderful club, right, would do a program on, gender equity in law firms and transparency of pay. But what we have done is we've made it very easy for local bar associations to have conversations with the managing partners and compensation committees of every law firm in their jurisdiction. So what is that about? We have actual guidelines, all right, to talk about what would change compensation in law firms. Law firms right now, the large ones are managed by committees, all right, and some very small committees are in charge of compensation. Those committees are not gender and racially diverse. The reasons those committees are not diverse is this vicious circle. You have to be making a huge amount of money, all right, to be on those committees. How about, although it's anti-California law, which I can really yell about here, how about a little bit of affirmative action, right? How about a little bit of, you don't have to make $10 million a year to be on the compensation committee, but you do have to be a significant and respected contributor to your firm. And then we will put people of color and women on this committee so that we can make compensation fair and so that we can succession plan. So the people who are inheriting the files of huge corporations, of legal business to a law firm, are the people that the general counsels might like to see more diverse, not simply who the person who's controlled this business for 40 or 50 years chooses because he is more comfortable with that person. So can we diversify the succession plan? Can we get general counsels involved in saying, I want a diverse team? Can we get general counsels involved in being comfortable about speaking to the law firms they hire? And we're working on that right now. And the general counsels, who are in many cases reticent to involve themselves in the business of law with the people they hire, understand that, in fact, if they want a diverse team of lawyers and they want to make certain that their women and people of color are on that team and being recognized with origination credit and pay and the opportunity to represent them on the next case and the next case into the future, they will need to get involved. So transparency, yes. A little bit more of diversity on the compensation committee until, with that diversification, then we have women who are attracting and retaining huge clients. Perfectly, appropriate, and so it will grow. But right now, unless we take some very definite steps, we are not going to be seeing women at the top. I'm tired of saying, let's wait. All right, let's wait is not my favorite expression, in case you hadn't figured that out. All right, but the reason I'm saying let's wait's not my favorite expression is because when Hillary Clinton was first chair of the American Bar Association's Commission on Women, she did a report on the status of women in the profession. And that report said in 1985, barriers persist and they will not be eradicated by the increase in numbers of women in the profession. Those barriers will persist. And then when I chaired the Commission on Women a few years later, and we did the next report to see how we were doing 6 or 7 years later, it was barriers persist, and the advent of numbers of women will not eradicate bias. And guess what? All right, 2013, we're still there. Did you all know, by the way, that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act that protects us from gender and racial and ethnic discrimination is the only statute in the country that has caps on damages?
On that cheery note, I want to remind our listening audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Laurel Bellows, president of the American Bar Association, who is discussing legal and ethical challenges facing the American justice system, and I might say America generally. Laurel, let's shift again now to another theme that you've been very active in, and that's around access to justice. And again, if you read your wonderfully articulate pieces on the website or listen to the many YouTubes that you've done, you do have great faith in the civil jury system as setting us apart. But I want to ask a question that somebody has asked, which I think goes to a deeper, another systemic problem. Can we really create the access to which we all aspire without more structural fundamental change? And let me read this question because I think it goes to the root of the problem. The writer cites a book from the 1950s, Two Cheers for Democracy, written by a political scientist in the 1950s before Washington's dysfunction was so blatant. We're unable to remedy the role of money, she continues, in clogging the system. Is the ABA working on a template to remedy the problem? So I guess the question really is, without cash in the hands of ordinary citizens to affect the system, how can we gain the access that we want?
I'm not just saying it's a great question because that buys me a little time on a huge question. I'm saying it because it's at the foundation of our system. Access to justice is something we don't have for all, and access to justice for all is the precept of our country. And for 25 or 30 years, we were talking about the inability of people of poverty to access justice, that 80% of the legal needs of the poor were not met in this country. Well, actually, that's growing as opposed to diminishing. So we know we're not making any progress in meeting the legal needs of the poor. And then we have the middle class that can't afford a lawyer in this country. And then we have the underfunding of our justice system that we just started talking about, where L.A. County closes 200 courtrooms. And in San Francisco, you here at home, have just kind of narrowly escaped the loss of 50% of your justice system. And in Illinois is about to flounder. And there are states where people have to bring paper and pens to court. And there are states where our justice courts are closed every Friday. And there are a couple of states in this country who are not trying any civil cases for a year, because they have to meet the Speedy Trial Act requirements, and so they're only able to try criminal cases. How in the world does our country function and give access to justice? Well, we begin to think about the positive uses of technology. We begin to reinvent what is necessary to be heard in court and what isn't, what is really criminal, jailable activity and what isn't. We begin to be willing to question from scratch how our justice system functions. But that doesn't mean that we give away and give up on the precepts of our justice system. As I said, that doesn't mean, because we think it might be a little bit more efficient, that we allow waivers of a civil jury on contracts that are on my desk right now. Those contracts used to say, refer to arbitration. And now those contracts are beginning to say, waive your jury. Go to court, but waive your jury. So mediation, which is a big item here in California, but is really not accepted anywhere else in the country. Arbitration, not my favorite, because All right. It has become long and complex, and a lot of continuances even suffers from many things that our justice system and the courts suffer from. But I think we have to be willing to question, are there times when we don't have to be face-to-face? Do we have to have a traffic court the way we have one? Can we have a traffic court that's virtual? Can we try certain parts of cases virtually? And when it comes to the preservation of the jury system, Jeffrey, I mean, what we have done at the American Bar Association that I'm very proud of is promulgated some jury standards and some new ways of trying juries that are much more efficient. So, one, we don't think that every big trial, complex trial, has to be 3 or 4 or 5 months. We believe in giving judges the ability to do fast-track trials and force our attorneys to choose their best witnesses and their best experts and the issues that are honed. So we can have faster and efficient jury trials. We can allow our juries to ask questions. We can talk. We can give opening and closing statements before every expert, so our juries actually understand the most complex of cases, which means we will have more confidence in our jury system. So there's that in the jury system, but I think we're going to find court systems that aren't all face-to-face, so we're going to have to decide what is the most important trial that has to be in person and before whom, and began to take a look at a court system that needs to function in a different way than it is. And the good news, the glass half full news, is there are lots of courts in the country that are starting to look at those systems.
Great. Let's pan back from the access issue and talk about the profession generally. Mm-hmm. Bob Weeks, who gave such a beautiful introduction, handed me his card about an hour ago, and on the back he's got stamped, "Lawyers are noble instruments of justice who help people." And I know there are law deans in this room, and I know there are law professors in this room, and many lawyers, and I hope many people, who believe deeply in what is stamped on the back of Bob's card. But the question, one is a general one about the image of lawyers today, and one is one that is a tremendous concern to those of us in legal education. What is the answer to the problems that plague legal education as we're caught in this perfect storm of a collapsed job market, incredible crushing debt, assassins of the student spirit everywhere? How does the profession respond to this, and does it mean that the profession has to change its own image before we can respond?
Well, first, let's talk about the tough one. I mean, the ABA has appointed a committee, and whenever I say appointed a committee, everybody kind of shuts down, right? But we have brought together the experts, the most clever and creative deans and academics and young lawyers and law students to begin to see, can we design from scratch a new way to educate lawyers? What we're doing, by the way, is doing a very good job of educating lawyers, but we could do it better. How? And do we want to draw from the European system, and do we want to make, you know, require practical internships after law school? Or do we need law school, all right? Or is in many European countries and other countries, you become a lawyer because you take that direction as your college instead of as your graduate education? All of these issues are being addressed right now on a very expedited schedule, and there will be a report in the fall. So I don't want to really speak to that because these folks are really examining from the very beginning what we can do to affect law students and law legal education. But I say to law students, I say it to you, I couldn't have chosen a more amazing career because I could be an estate planner, I could be in public service, I could be a merger and acquisition, I could be a criminal defense lawyer or a criminal prosecutor. I could do so many things with my law degree to help people, help me, help my family. The choices are infinite. And so I say to law students, please, you chose well. Tough time, you chose well. There's a Sidley and an Austin that's a mega firm right now. But there was a Sidley. There was a Mr. Austin. There was a Mr. Winston, and there was a Mr. Strawn. And they came together and built law firms. If you want to practice law, the American Bar Association is helping solo practitioners begin to build a business of law, which can represent people. You don't have to earn $250 an hour. You can represent people who need you. in a different context and be very personally satisfied with what you do. Because the law does, all right, speak to all of us, and we are problem solvers, and I could never discourage anyone from choosing that as a profession.
That is a beautiful answer to a question. Just so the person knows that you were channeling it, the question was, what advice do you have to future lawyers to best be able to contribute to better things? And what you gave was just a beautifully articulate response to that. I'd like to end on a note where the glass is totally full, which
okay.
is your personal life.
That's true.
You obviously have a wonderful family. You've said of your law partner and husband of all these years that he's given you your safety net. He taught you how to fly, all these wonderful, wonderful things. And reading about your personal life, you talk about the role of strong women in your own life, and you talk about the role of music. Mm. Could you just comment on those two?
Well, so I'm strong because I have a support net, just not only my husband, but this fabulous woman daughter that I have, and the excitement at all the things that we as women can and accomplish. But the role of music was my grandmother, who taught me how to play the piano when I was 4 years old, and pushed me forward to become a pianist. I don't play now, but then I have some news, which I understand is, you know, as my daughter begins to write music and play the piano herself, it's becoming a world round and beautiful. I am very lucky. I think that people have to understand, though, because I've also been quoted accurately as saying I don't believe in balance. And I think that those...
I think you said a work-life balance is a fraud.
I did say that. And I don't... And so that's an up note, actually, not a down note. It's that I want to convey to the women in this world, both lawyers and non-lawyers, and the men in this world, who I don't believe have a balanced life either, or should seek it, that life is fabulous because a full life is never balanced. And if you see me smiling like this today, looking like I have it all together, don't be fooled. There isn't a moment of balance in my life. And I do think it's a misrepresentation to encourage particularly young women who are trying to put together families and careers at the same time. I think it's a very, very... inaccurate message to say that somehow in that life of many purposes there would be balance as the goal. In fact, it should just be personal satisfaction in what you're doing at any given moment.
Wonderful. I don't live in Chicago, Laurel, but anytime you want to have a drink at Andy's on East Hubbard and listen to some jazz.
That's my neighborhood, Jeffrey.
Just let me know.
Come anytime.
Well, unfortunately, we have reached the end of our program, and I want to give thanks to Laurel Bellows, president of the American Bar Association, and I also want to thank the audience here that asked so many great questions, which unfortunately we could not get to, and also our audiences on radio, television, and on the Internet. I'm Jeff Brand, Dean of the University of San Francisco School of Law, where we do believe deeply in educating for justice and to change the world from here. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you, Laurel.